Well, welcome everyone to our first teleclass specifically on zoonosis. It's called The Blurring Interface of Human and Animal Diseases. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I would again like to thank you for joining us for this teleclass. Now, I look forward to every teleclass, but I've been especially looking forward to this one because of the person who is presenting. Our faculty today is Dr. Corey Brown. Dr. Brown is a doctor of veterinary medicine. She teaches and does research at the University of Georgia. As a matter of fact, just moments ago, she was running down the hall from a lab so she could be with us now. She is a regular conference speaker on topics of animal and human diseases, and including the recommendation of several people who said how wonderful she is, the students at her university voted her as best teacher. She is a wonderful person. To present the teleclass, The Blurring Interface Between Human and Animal Disease from the University of Georgia, I am honored to introduce Dr. Corey Brown.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. Corey Brown from the University of Georgia, and I'm especially happy to be speaking to so many Canadian colleagues. I have some Canadian roots. I did my Bachelor of Science degree at McGill University, and I did my DVM at the University of Guelph. So I have only the fondest of thoughts for Canada and all the good things that get done there. We're going to talk over the next 45 minutes about how public health and animal health are really becoming closely intertwined. On the first slide, you'll see a picture of the University of Georgia. We'll move to the next slide, which is a face that may be familiar to many of you. If his face isn't familiar, at least his name might be. This is Rudolf Virchow. Virchow is noted as the father of modern pathology, the cellular nature of disease. But what many people might not know about him is that he was the first person to use the term zoonosis. And he used this term zoonosis because of his work on trichinella. He really understood the interconnectedness of human and animal medicine, and in fact was a very big proponent of one medicine. This idea of one medicine, which Virchow proposed in the latter half of the 19th century, probably has a great deal of applicability today. So let's go to the next slide, which shows this stolen painting, The Scream, by Edward Munch. And this is really a gestalt for the whole field of infectious diseases and emerging diseases, which we're facing now. It's worthwhile remembering that 3/4 of all emerging diseases do in fact come from animals. So there's great value in integrating public health and animal health. The next slide, which has a picture of a Batman and Robin, or rather Watson and Crick, looking at a DNA molecule, let's remember that it's been over 50 years since Watson and Crick elaborated the structure of DNA. We've come a great way since then in terms of what we can do in biomedical sciences. And in fact, we have now sequenced the entire human genome, more than 1,500 different viruses, many bacteria, and really a plethora of eukaryotes. So we're in a position now where we not only know the genomic structure of our infectious agents, but we're also looking at the host response. So it's ironic that at a time when we're so perfectly poised to actually make progress on how infectious diseases happen and what the pathogenesis is, that we're faced with so many new diseases. And the next slide, which has a picture of the Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal, are we ready to confront all these new diseases? The last 10 years has seen whole institutes, training programs, fellowships, journals, meetings, all devoted to this subject of emerging infectious diseases. These emerging infectious diseases are happening not only in people, but we're also seeing brand new diseases in animals, to the point where the American Society for Microbiology, they do an emerging disease volume every year, and 3 years ago they did one that was strictly devoted to emerging diseases of animals. The next slide lists all these underlying factors of disease emergence, and these are factors that I'm sure you're all already familiar with, but what we need to keep in mind is that there are many factors, and with these factors there's a tremendous amount of synergy, overlap, and really it's a multiplier effect. what's been the big change that has allowed all of these diseases to happen? If we go to the next slide, globalization is a huge factor in this. And this globalization, which has been articulated so well by Thomas Friedman in The Lexus and the Olive Tree, globalization is the interconnectedness of all people, economies, cultures, and it is going to have a bigger impact on our lives today than the Industrial Revolution had on the lives of people 150 years ago. So whether you agree with globalization or not, it is really causing a great impact on us, and it's not something that we can easily stop. So we need to learn to live with it, accommodate it, and look out for infectious disease problems that could arise as a result. So the next slide is a map of the United States with a fence around it. Of course, this is it's to demonstrate that we have so much free trade that there really are no fences between countries anymore. The amount of traffic of people, animals, animal products between countries is really voluminous, and it increases every year. So trying to protect our countries by building a fence around them is really not realistic, and it's not a good prevention strategy. But it's also worth remembering that we don't have any really have any good fences between countries. We also don't have any fences between species. So let's look at this next slide, which is a cover the front page of a journal article by Dr. Cleveland and her colleagues in the UK. And Dr. Cleveland actually made a list of all of the known pathogens of humans and the animals that they steward. So she looked at all the diseases of humans, and she counted there 1,415 different pathogens that will cause diseases in people. We go to the next slide, which is a bar graph. She also looked at domestic livestock and domestic carnivores, our dogs and cats. And she found that there were just over 600 pathogens that will cause disease in domestic livestock and just under 400 for carnivores. Now, so those are the known pathogens in each of those animal groups. If we look at the number of pathogens that can actually move from one species to another, and if we're talking about humans, then we have to call those diseases zoonotic. So we go to the next graph, which shows the percentage of human diseases that actually come from animals, that are multi-species. And as you can see, 60% of human infections are zoonotic. Well, what about those infections of domestic livestock and domestic carnivores? We can't call them zoonotic if they move between species because they're already in zoological species. So we'll refer to them as multiple species. And the next graph, which shows some blue-colored areas representing the multiple species, so that we have most of the pathogens of domestic livestock and virtually all of the pathogens of domestic carnivores can infect more than one species. But what is missing from this graph? Well, the thing that is missing, and it's something that we certainly don't have any way to get a handle on it today, is wildlife. So if you go to the last graph in the series, it's just a big black box with a lot of question marks. We really have no idea about the number of pathogens that are in wildlife, and we certainly don't know the percentage of those pathogens that can cross from one species to another. But in all likelihood, it's very high, and it's going to be 60 to 80% like we see in the other species. So, are we ready? Are we ready, as we mix all these species together, are we ready for new disease? Or are we like the guy in the outhouse in this next slide, which is a Far Side cartoon? This is it, Jenkins, indisputable proof that the Ice Age caught these people completely off guard. I think that maybe initially we were caught off guard with some of the emerging diseases. I certainly hope that we are out of the outhouse now and making full preparations for the onslaught. Let's look at a few diseases that have really blurred the interface between human and animal medicine. We'll go to the next slide, which is titled Ebola, a Continuing Saga. Ebola virus is really a bit player in terms of the overall mortality, morbidity associated with emerging diseases. But it has really captured the attention of the general public, and because of the very gruesome nature of the pathologic changes, it has become a kind of poster child for the whole emerging disease arena. We see Ebola virus, I mean, this is a perfect example of a disease that goes between humans and animals. Certainly it was first reported in humans, and then we're looking for the animal reservoir, and what we know now is that Ebola virus is in fact causing tremendous declines in our great ape populations. So it's affecting both humans and animals. And you may notice the picture in the middle of that slide of Nancy Jacks, who's a veterinary pathologist. She worked on Ebola virus when it emerged in Reston, Virginia, and she is one of the protagonists in the popular book written by Richard Preston, The Hot Zone. And it was largely that book and some other incidents at that time that catapulted emerging disease research and activity into the attention of the general public. Nancy Jacks and Jerry Jacks, two veterinarians, protagonists of that book, Hollywood took the book and made it into a movie, Outbreak, and I'm sure many of you have seen that movie, and have some problems with Outbreak. First of all, they took Nancy and Jerry Jacks, two veterinarians, and turned them into Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo and made them two MDs. So to me, that tells me veterinarians are not quite ready for prime time. Also, there's some other problems with the movie. You may remember that monoclonal antibody producing machine. Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to have one of those? And of course, another problem is that Dustin Hoffman could be Rene Russo's father. I want to know when they're going to make a movie that portrays women scientists as incipient curmudgeons like the guys and not just the young, glamorous women. But that's an editorial comment. Let's go on to the next slide, which is all about BSE, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, a disease that unfortunately got dubbed by the media mad cow disease. There's really nothing mad about these cows. These cows are sad, not mad. This was first noted in cattle in the United Kingdom in 1987 and was of great interest to veterinary regulatory authorities around the world. Caused by a prion agent, an emerging disease of cattle, and we now know that the source was meat and bone meal that was ground up from animals that had this prion disease. Prion disease, what is that? Let's go to the next slide. All the prion diseases are considered transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, and for all of them, they have the same pathogenesis. That is, they're caused by prions, also known as proteinaceous infectious particles. This is a term that was coined by Stanley Prusiner in his 1982 article in Science about these encephalopathies. And I find it interesting in that article, PRO is underlined and IN is underlined, and he proposes the term prion. Now, I know that he won a Nobel Prize, but I also wonder, shouldn't it be prion? And the way that these prions work is that an abnormally folded protein will then sidle up next to a normally folded protein and induce that protein to undergo post-translational modification so that that protein also undergoes this flattened shape. Then these flattened prions are not susceptible to degradation within the cell. They build up within the cell and appear as vacuoles, and so that's what gives the brain the spongy appearance and is responsible for the name spongiform. Well, as I mentioned, BSE was of great interest to all of the veterinary regulatory people in the late 80s. And the UK decided to keep a close watch on what might happen with human disease. So we'll go to the next slide. They set up a spongiform encephalopathy advisory committee to look at all of the cases of neurologic disease in humans to hopefully pinpoint if they saw a new disease emerging that could be a result of BSE getting into the human population. And in fact, in March of 1996, they announced to the House of Lords that they had 10 cases that really looked like they could be a new entity, a spongiform encephalopathy, and it really gave the term beef eater a whole new connotation. So go to the next slide. What the Spongiform Encephalopathy Advisory Committee noted was that Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which had always occurred in the population, has this distribution, as you see on the right side of the table, in older people, a rapid disease course, whereas this new entity they had seen, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob, primarily affected younger people. The disease course was much more prolonged, And there was a big difference in terms of the degree of amyloid plaques, or PRP plaques, that were noted in the brain histologically. So I would say that this variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease has really become a disaster. We look at the next slide, which is a picture of the grave of one of the youngest victims of this disease. Because this disease attacks people in the prime of life, and it's a slow, insidious disease, although there have only been 135 cases, it has become a disease that the public really wants a no-risk guarantee for. So that has changed the way we do a lot of things with our cattle industries. So it's a good example of blurring interface, human and animal health. The next slide has a series of pictures on it. We have a number of emerging diseases, really a hat trick of emerging diseases that came from Australia. First, we had the Hendra virus, which emerged in horses, caused severe pulmonary edema, and you see the froth from that horse's nares. Severe pulmonary edema, and it caused the death of a trainer who was caring for the animals. We had meningovirus, which caused abnormalities in newborn piglets. Here we have piglets with arthrogryposis and brachygnathia. And then we had a disease that was discovered in bats, lysavirus. All three of these diseases are thought to have emerged from bats, particularly fruit bats of the Pteropus genus, the giant fruit bats, also known as flying foxes. So you see pictures of the fruit bats hanging there in the lab in Australia where they did the studies. Now, Hendra virus killed people, killed horses. Meningovirus caused fetal abnormalities, gave people a flu-like syndrome. They discovered that both Hendra and Menengo came from fruit bats, so they started looking closely at the fruit bats, and they found that they started looking at bat rehabilitators. They found a woman who had cared for a bat who was in the hospital. She was in a coma. She had encephalitis. She died. They looked at her brain post-mortem, and she had a Lyssa virus. They found the same Lyssa virus in some bats. So tell me, if you have a Lyssa virus, comes from bats, causes encephalitis in people, what are you going to call it? Well, if you live just about anywhere in the world, you're going to call it rabies. But if you live in Australia, you probably don't want to call it rabies because Australia is free of rabies. So instead, they called it Australian Bat Lyssa Virus 4. So there we have lack of intersection between politics and science, which happens from time to time. So all of these diseases were studied in containment. We have a picture there on the lower left of Mark Williamson and Peter Hooper, two veterinary pathologists who did a lot of the work on these agents. And really, my hat's off to them because I can't imagine what it would be like working with infected horses in high containment. I mean, what do you do when the horse steps on your air hose? Oh, excuse me. And the next slide shows how you might feel if a horse stepped on your air hose. Okay, but those three diseases were really pale in comparison to what we saw in Malaysia in 1999. So here we have on this next slide, diseases from fruit bats, we have a picture of one of these giant flying foxes or giant fruit bats. And you see the three diseases that we've talked about already. The world was really not ready for this new virus that emerged in 1999 in Malaysia. So to take a little bit out of literature, twinkle, twinkle, little bat, how I wonder what you've got. Or how I wonder what you're at, which is Lewis Carroll. Let's go to the next slide, which is Nipah virus in Malaysia. This was a tremendous outbreak. What happened was the virus was transferred to pigs from fruit bats that were clustered near the pigs because there was a huge effort at increasing the pig rearing capabilities in one area of Malaysia. Also, there was development of the orchard industry, same areas, and there were fires in Indonesia, which drove many of the fruit bats from their natural habitat out into these orchards in Malaysia. So we have fruit bats feeding on the orchards in Malaysia, and they're defecating and urinating very close to the piggeries. Well, sooner or later, this virus, Nipah virus, which does not cause any kind of disease in bats, got into the pigs and caused a severe bronchitis, bronchiolitis, but with very little mortality. And the pigs would cough a lot of virus. Actually, the disease was referred to as barking pig syndrome. So you have pigs that are coughing and spewing out massive amounts of virus, which when it gets into the humans nearby, the virus gets into the respiratory epithelium, makes a beeline for the brain, and what you're seeing there in that upper right is a big swath of necrosis that the virus has cut to the cerebrum of an infected person. So in order to control the disease, they killed 1 million pigs. Here we have examples of people working in biocontainment level 4 type conditions at the equator, not an easy task. And they actually destroyed many of the swine farms, even though this virus is easily inactivated by disinfectant. They actually destroyed some of the swine farms to ensure that the disease was gone. This next slide, which shows a picture of soldiers firing into a pit of pigs, really demonstrates the interface of public health and animal health, maybe like no other visual. So here we have army recruits that have herded pigs into a big pit and are killing them with their rifles. At the far end of the picture, you will see one of the army recruits who couldn't see very well. Evidently, his mask was fogged. He took his mask off so he could see better. There were, in fact, quite a few people who died, quite a few of the army people who were brought in to kill the pigs, who died as a result of exposure in this manner. So it's always important to remember the personal protective equipment, and that's probably not something that hospital infection control people need to hear. It's a bit like preaching to the choir. We have this next slide here, which is a humorous slide depicting the importance of personal protective equipment. Yes, what is that guy thinking? Let's look at a few more diseases. The next slide is about West Nile virus. This came into the U.S. in 1999. Tracy McNamara, a veterinarian at the Bronx Zoo on the lower right, is the one who sounded the alarm when she saw crows and flamingos dying in her exhibits. She alerted the public health authorities. The response happened, but by then this was a new virus that had been introduced to New York, and it had spread far and wide. West Nile virus. It is now well established in all 3 countries in North America, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. There's no hope of eradicating it here, and South America is just waiting for the onslaught. This is a disease that, an emerging disease here that is now endemic. We have to deal with it. It's responsible for considerable morbidity, mortality, and very expensive in terms of control measures. But that emerging disease might just be a hiccup compared to another severe emerging disease, and that's Rift Valley fever on the next slide. Rift Valley fever is a disease that affects both humans and animals. We usually see it in sheep and goats. It will present as an abortion storm or hepatic failure. It replicates in the sheep and goats, produces a tremendous amount of infection in the mosquito population, and from there it spills over to affect humans. In humans, it causes a flu-like illness, but sometimes it's accompanied by a hemorrhagic syndrome. It was always confined to Africa, especially the eastern part of Africa, which is where the Rift Valley is, but then there was an outbreak in the Arabian Peninsula in 2000. It probably came in with sheep that were imported through Yemen for the Hajj, because it's part of the Hajj that each person who makes the Hajj sacrifices a sheep at the end of the trip. So lots of sheep are imported into Saudi Arabia through Yemen every year. It's thought that some sheep came over from Saudi Arabia or Ethiopia or Kenya. They had the virus, took it into Saudi Arabia and Yemen. What was really scary about this outbreak in the Arabian Peninsula was that we always thought Rift Valley fever had about a 5% mortality rate. But in the case in Saudi Arabia and Yemen, where we had 2,000 human infections, there was up to 26% mortality. So with West Nile virus, we're talking about a 0.01% mortality. Here we have Rift Valley fever, up to a 26% mortality. Both are transmitted by mosquitoes. So if Rift Valley fever comes into the U.S. or into Canada in a mosquito season, I'm not kidding when I say it's going to make West Nile look like a hiccup. Let's go to the next slide, which is a little bit of art. This is a printing by Escher, and I think that this picture demonstrates we're talking about all of these diseases, Ebola, BSE, Hendra, Nipah, West Nile, Rift Valley fever, Are they an animal disease or are they a human disease? Well, they're both. And this picture is called rabbit duck. So all these diseases are both. Just depends on your point of view as to how you approach them. Let's go to the next slide, which is the emerging disease of the day, highly pathogenic avian influenza. A little bit of background about high-path AI. Next slide has a very large host range. It infects a number of birds. In the aquatic birds, it usually does not show up as any disease. So these aquatic birds carry it around. It gets into poultry and can cause massive devastation. Well, these aquatic birds carry it around. Next slide. And the virus gets transmitted through their feces because I think we refer to these animals as indiscreet defecators. Yeah, so wherever their feces go, which is a lot of places, you can get the virus. We're now looking at the largest outbreak of high-path AI that has ever occurred. The next slide demonstrates some of the control measures that are being taken in Southeast Asia. To date, over 100 million chickens have been killed to try and control the spread of this disease. There's a very serious problem with this particular H5N1 virus of the high-path AI is that it's also spread to people. Look at the next slide. There are 10 countries in Southeast Asia that have been affected with this highly pathogenic avian influenza. And we also see on the right there some of the chicken husbandry conditions, some of the collecting conditions, which is going to make it very challenging to control the spread of this disease. I think in those cages we probably have both horizontal and vertical transmission. The next slide is a table from the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization was keeping daily tallies of mortalities due to high-path AI. They ended the end of March 2004, when they recorded 23 deaths due to high-path AI out of 34 recorded cases. They have not updated the tables, but as of 2 weeks ago, there were some additional human cases with mortality in Vietnam. So this has not stopped, and the number of deaths has increased. Well, if you look at the number of deaths, 23 deaths, 34 cases, I don't know, that looks like a very high case fatality rate. Of course, all of the cases have been people who've been exposed to chickens. So it appears that the only way a human can get the virus right now is to have contact with sick chickens. So we can control the spread to some extent. Of course, the huge concern is, what happens if a human is incubating a human influenza at the same time that they're infected with the avian influenza? Then we'll get a recombination event, and there is a possibility that we'll get the gene that allows for human-to-human transmission from the human virus and the gene that causes a 70 or 60% mortality rate from the avian portion, and then we will have the next pandemic of influenza. How close is this to happening? Next slide. Well, we're not only worried about people incubating the disease and creating the pandemic. Now, we also have to worry about pigs. It turns out that in some of these countries, there have been pigs infected also. Certainly, pigs are somewhat closer to humans than chickens. If the avian influenza virus gets into pigs, would that make it more transmissible to humans? And I think many of you may be aware of the article in Science that appeared last week where the Dutch group actually took the avian influenza virus, put it into cats. They got disease and death in cats, and they also showed that the virus could be transmitted from infected cats to non-infected cats by contact. So we're talking about really complicated infection control. The next slide. Fortunately, all the groups are working together on this, and this might be the first time in history that the OIE, which is the equivalent of the World Animal Health Organization, the WHO, which is, of course, for human health, and the FAO, which is a branch, Food and Agriculture Organization, a branch of the UN, they're all working together on this high-path AI scenario. The next slide. Because we are all, in fact, very related, animals, people, cultures. It's all part of the infection disease dynamics, and we have to take into account all aspects. The next slide. We've seen this before. It's not an option to close our barriers, and in fact, a disease that occurs in one part of the world can very easily move to another part of the world. Next slide. As Joshua Lederberg said, and he has been a leader in the field of emerging diseases, exotic disease is an oxymoron. What occurs in one corner of the world can spread easily. The time it takes to circumnavigate the world is less than the incubation period for most diseases. The next slide, another little bit of art. We are all interconnected like the lines in this Jackson Pollock drawing of a wolf. Are we ready for the next big new emerging disease? Well, if you look at the next slide, which is an X-ray that came out of Hong Kong, are we ready? We certainly geared up to prepare for this outbreak. Next slide, which as you all know is SARS. There's some histologic pictures of the lung of people infected with SARS with the giant cells and the horrendous fibrinous necrotizing pneumonia. SARS coronavirus, next slide. This virus was in fact on the move. And I don't think I have to remind anyone in Canada of how easily it moved and of the tremendous economic devastation that it caused to the countries that were affected. Next slide. Is a diagram for Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Review, and it's a diagram demonstrating the very fluid nature of human movement and how one person from this Hotel M the virus was able to disseminate to so many different countries so rapidly. And I find it very interesting that in that particular hotel in Hong Kong, this floor where everyone was staying was a non-smoking floor. So the air there was recirculating, and they believe that contributed to the infection among the people there. They have recirculated air rather than fresh air from outside. So you didn't inhale any smoke, but you did inhale the SARS virus. That's just not fair. Next slide. There was a massive global run on personal protective equipment, and we watched the whole world, the public health community from the whole world, move into action. It was really quite gratifying to watch. The next slide shows Cynthia Goldsmith, who is the electron microscopist at the CDC, and she was the first person to utter the word coronavirus. Well, we know that there were 8,000 or so people infected with the coronavirus, a relatively high mortality rate. Is it gone from the world? The next slide. There was an accident in China a few months ago where actually it came from the lab. The virus got into a person who was working with it in the lab, and that person took it home and spread it to several people. So we need to be careful in our laboratories. And if you look at the cartoon on the right, Center for the Study of Viral Pathology, and the scientist in the window is saying, uh-oh, I would imagine that the laboratory directors at the lab in China probably said something a little bit more colorful than uh-oh. Next slide. What is the truth about SARS? Where did it come from? Well, what is the truth? We'll look at the next slide. It's a dog looking in the garbage. Are we looking in the right places for this virus? The next slide. Civet cats have been implicated in the spread of SARS. And in order to control SARS, 10,000 civet cats were killed in China. Is that the right thing to do? Then they found the virus in rats. Next slide. So a campaign was undertaken to kill all of the rats. Well, I'm not sure we should do infection control by species extermination. Next slide. But sometimes that's our approach to emerging diseases. We need to really think very carefully. You may be familiar with this carnival game, Whack-A-Mole, where you pay 50 cents and for 10 minutes you can use a rubber mallet to hit any mole that pops out of the hole. Well, is this how we're responding to emerging diseases? Just as each new disease arises, we are jumping on it and trying to eradicate it. I suspect what we need is a much better understanding of what's going on below the surface, so that we have a better predictability of what to do when a new disease arises. What are the connections that we need to be looking for? Well, let's look at a disease that's a little closer to home for us here, and that is monkeypox. This little Shauna Kotzer from Wisconsin, she and her family went out and bought two prairie dogs for Mother's Day 2 years ago. She ended up with these lesions on her fingers. She had a febrile illness. The next slide, the mother also got some lesions. They actually isolated monkeypox from the lesion on the little girl's finger and also from the prairie dogs that they had bought at the swap meet. Prairie dogs. What are we doing putting prairie dogs into human homes? Let's look at the next slide. We now know that prairie dogs were mixed with giant Gambian rats on their journey over. When the rats came over from Africa, there was monkeypox virus in the rats. They were mixed with prairie dogs. Prairie dogs got the virus. Prairie dogs took it to people. 53 cases in 4 states. We have exported prairie dogs all over the world. I think we've exported 70,000 prairie dogs to Japan. Prairie dogs don't make very good pets. So there's an awful lot of people who buy prairie dogs, and then the prairie dogs either escape from the homes or they have an intentional escape because the family wants to get rid of them. So prairie dogs are probably not a good thing to keep. Let's look at the next slide. Like we didn't already know, prairie dogs were bad news. 2 summers ago, prairie dogs were exported to a number of, they were collected, exported to a number of different states and also 5 different foreign countries. The prairie dogs that were left at the distributors in the U.S. became ill and tularemia was cultured from them. So the head of Health and Human Services and the head of the Department of Agriculture had to get on the telephone to their counterparts in these 5 other countries and say, oh, gee, we're sorry, we just sent you a Category A agent, a little furry animal destined for someone's living room. Of course, prairie dogs also carry plague, and about every 10 years there's a big die-off of plague among prairie dogs. Die-off of prairie dogs due to plague. And it's thought that plague circulates continually in the prairie dogs, and just when it reaches a certain state, then it kills them all. So prairie dogs are always a threat for plague. And I mentioned that we've sent 70,000 prairie dogs to Japan. In fact, it's believed that these prairie dogs are out-competing the rats in the sewers of Tokyo. So I can just imagine in some sort of life imitates art scenario that a prairie dog emerges from one of these manholes to spread plague through the city. And then who would be the bioterrorist then? Let's look at the next slide. We are, in fact, mixing incompatible species at an incredible rate. Look at this far side. Zorak, you idiot, you've mixed incompatible species in the Earth terrarium. And we need to be careful about putting evolutionarily incompatible species together because we just don't know what kinds of diseases we're going to get. And we are doing that, as you can see from that prairie dog with the palm tree in the sunset. We're not only doing it in our homes for our entertainment, but we're also doing it commercially. Let's look at the next slide, which has statistics about wildlife ranching. In South Africa alone, about a third of the wild game ranches actually have domestic animals mixed with wild animals. We think we do a lot of deer farming here in the U.S. and Canada, but we can't hold a candle to what gets done in New Zealand and China, where there are a lot of animals that are raised for export, and often these animals are mixed with domestic animals. Of course, we've got lots of iguanas exported from Costa Rica every year, many things from Brazil, and even in the U.S., we export more turtles than we import. We import turtles to use as pets, and we export something like 2 million turtles a year, red-eared slider turtles that go to the Orient for food. So there's all this commercial traffic in exotic species, and they're often mixing with other species along the way. Okay, let's go to a more intimate interface, and this is the interface, the environmental interface in the home. We have a blurring interface between public and animal health if we look in the home. We have an awful lot of pets in the U.S., and the next slide shows statistics about pets. 136 million dogs and cats in the U.S. In the U.S., we have 62 million households with pets and 31 million households with children. So we have twice as many households have pets as have children. So this human-animal bond is becoming very important, and we are really seeing this in the veterinary profession, where animal owners are willing to go to very long lengths to ensure the longevity of their pets. Human-animal bond, primarily dogs and cats, but we're also seeing it to some extent with other animals, iguanas, other reptiles, certainly many exotic birds. And we have diseases that are emerging from these pets. Let's go to the next slide that lists the five main emerging diseases that we're seeing from pets. And we'll talk about each of these. The next slide. Cat scratch disease and capnocytophaga canamorsis. Diseases that come from apparently healthy cats and dogs. Cat scratch disease is caused by Bartonella henslei. It's carried by primarily kittens. It's a bacteremia that occurs in kittens. They can be bacteremic for as long as 18 months. It's probably transmitted from one kitten to another via a flea bite. We don't see this disease very much in parts of the country or parts of the world where there aren't very many fleas, where it's environmentally unfriendly for fleas. But like in this area in the southeast, we have a very high seropositivity rate for Bartonella henslei in our cats. So then the kitten scratches a person, and we get a cervical lymphadenopathy, as you see in that upper right picture. It's a cervical lymphadenopathy, about a six-week disease of malaise, headache, and in immunocompromised people, it will spread farther and cause a very serious septicemia. About 7% of all veterinarians are positive for Bartonella, serologically positive. Another disease that we get from a pet that is apparently healthy is capnocytophaga canamorsis. This is a very fastidious bacteria, lives in the oral cavity of about 17% of all dogs. Now, this gets into a human when the dog bites you or licks an open wound, and if you have any degree of immunocompromise, it will cause a septicemia, meningitis, endocarditis, and peripheral symmetrical gangrene. Very high mortality rate associated with capnocytophaga canamorsis. Next slide. The third of the emerging diseases from pets, salmonellosis. Salmonella is a perennial problem. It is one of the major zoonotic diseases, and we are now seeing more disease causation in humans due to their pets. On the lower right, you see the salmonella in the intestine of a calf. A human intestine could look the same with very severe salmonellosis. Where we mostly see zoonotic disease in humans is from reptiles. An awful lot of reptiles will carry salmonella. And just about all of the little pet turtles that you used to be able to buy in Woolworths, I think about 100% of them had salmonella. In iguanas, something like 95% of all iguanas have salmonella. I find this article quite interesting. This was a young man who had a boa constrictor. He donated his platelets. He was clinically normal, but evidently he had a bacteremia that he'd gotten from his boa constrictor, and everyone who got his platelets got salmonella infection. Next slide. The next two diseases are particularly scary, I think. They are emerging, and they are very serious. So we should be looking at a diagram of the life cycle of a tapeworm. This is Echinococcus multilocularis. This is the tapeworm that lives in the intestine of Arctic carnivores. The eggs are shed, picked up by a rodent. The cysts develop. The intermediate form of the tapeworm develops in the liver or lungs of the rodent. The carnivore eats the rodent, and the cycle is completed. Problems happen when humans interrupt the cycle. The humans can pick up the eggs from the environment, and they can develop these same cysts in the liver that we see in the rodents and the rabbits. So the next slide shows a rabbit liver that is affected by cysts of Echinococcus multilocularis, and this is referred to as alveolar hydatid disease. The liver is the target organ. Unfortunately, when it occurs in people, usually by the time it's diagnosed, more than half of the liver can be affected, and the only way to treat it really is by surgical excision. We'll go to the next slide, which shows surgical excision of some of these tremendous alveolar hydatid cysts in the liver of a human. There are some problems associated with removal of these cysts. if removal of them can cause severe shock. Also, if the surgeon happens to nick one of these cysts and it drains back into the peritoneal cavity, your peritoneal cavity has just been seeded with daughter cysts. So it's a disease with a fairly high mortality rate. We are now seeing that there are dogs who are picking up these Arctic tapeworms. Then they come back into the household. Of course, we all know what dogs do. You know, they lick their anus. And then they lick you, and they've just transferred that egg to you. We're also seeing a problem where we have dogs and northern carnivores defecating in gardens. It gets on the lettuce. The lettuce is in your salad, and we see the disease that way. The last disease we're going to talk about is the next slide, which is Bailus ascaris procyonis. This is the ascarid of raccoons. You have the life cycle there. Most raccoons carry this ascarid, and it doesn't cause any disease in the raccoons. The problem is that when the raccoons defecate, there's a whole lot of eggs that are shed into the environment, and then if a human picks up the eggs, usually it's a child, ingests those eggs, they become larvae and go to the brain. So the next slide shows evidence of these larvae in the brain, and I want to tell you that I'm a member of the Free Association, so I thought that this particular lesion in the brain looked an awful lot like the Klimt painting of the kiss. So I guess that's art imitates life. Next slide. These raccoons are just bad news. They carry so many diseases, and this is probably the scariest disease. They can defecate millions of these eggs. These eggs are kind of sticky. They stick to things like children's little plastic toys. They tend to have latrine areas, so there can be foci that are extremely highly contaminated, and children get into those areas, and it will result in a parasitic encephalitis. The disease is almost invariably fatal. Next slide, which is a big question mark. So what are we doing? Are we ready? Next slide. I think what we need to remember is we have to expect the unexpected. Anything can happen. We have to be ready for everything, and we really need to emphasize good comparative medicine training so that we're thinking across all species, we're thinking about the environment, and we're thinking in a big picture, multidisciplinary way. I will end with a picture of the next slide, which is Pet Dr. Barbie. I'll tell you a little story about Pet Dr. Barbie. I am a veterinarian. I'm a veterinary pathologist. I work on infectious diseases. Mattel came out with this Pet Dr. Barbie a couple of years ago, and, it just kind of pissed me off. Because this Pet Dr. Barbie, on the back of the box says, Pet Dr. Barbie has everything her puppies and kitties need to feel better, tender, loving care. And the name tag on Pet Dr. Barbie doesn't say Dr. Barbie, it just says Barbie. So I feel that this is the public's perception of what veterinarians do. They think we keep puppies and kitties feeling good with tender, loving care, and we're not really considered to be a kind of doctor. So I wrote a letter to Mattel, and I said, you know, we go through 4 years of pretty rigorous biomedical training, and when we're finished and we go out into the community, we're referred to as doctor. And you would be doing our profession a great service if you would change Barbie's name tag to Dr. Barbie. Thank you very much for your consideration. And I signed my name, Corey Brown, DVM, PhD. Well, they did write back to me, but they wrote back, Dear Ms. Brown. So that just tells me that we have a whole lot of work left to do, and I look forward to doing it. So thanks very much for your attention, and I'm sorry I couldn't be at the location where each and every one of you are to meet with you and talk to you, but I have enjoyed visiting with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brown, for a fantastic presentation. Your slides, I must say, are amazing and very descriptive, and I can certainly see why you're such a popular speaker. We'll have to get you back in 2005, as a matter of fact. Regarding West Nile virus, around my home, the mosquito crop this summer has been a bumper crop, certainly better than in recent memory. And this is despite control measures that the community has taken. However, confirmed West Nile cases are much lower in Canada, in eastern Ontario even, than last year. What would explain that?
I wonder, Could it have to do with the population, the species makeup of the mosquitoes? That would be one thing I'm thinking of. Another thing is perhaps there isn't that much West Nile in the mosquitoes. If you killed off a lot of crows from last year, maybe you're not getting the viremias that the mosquitoes are feeding on. And it will require a rebound effect before you see more cases of West Nile surfacing again. That's not an uncommon thing. The first year a disease comes in, it's a disaster. And the second year, it's not so bad because all the factors have changed, but then there's usually a rebound.
I was wondering perhaps if the immunity factor might be a contributor. If many of us have been exposed to very low doses and have become immune.
Oh, fewer human cases. Yeah, you know, in Jerusalem, 70% of the population of Jerusalem is seropositive for West Nile. So I think there's a whole lot of people infected who never know they're infected.
Secondly, you mentioned zoonotic diseases as bioterrorism. Is anyone looking at this about infecting animals who will then infect their humans?
We have done some work on the Category A agents, what they would look like if they showed up in pets. But I think that's more as a sentinel function rather than a distribution function. We're looking at that so that maybe we would detect it in animals and we could alert the human population. I don't know if anybody's talked about infecting animals with the idea of having it spread to people.
Just a comment for Dr. Brown. On her title, it says, Emerging Zoonosis, Blurring Interface of Human and Animal Diseases. I would, I guess, suggest that humans are animals.
Thank you.
So it's not surprising that, you know, there's this blurring interface. I always kind of get a kick. Sometimes you see restaurants that have posted a sign that say, no animals allowed. And I always think, well, that must be pretty hard on business.
Thank you.
That's a very astute observation. Thank you very much. Corey, again, thank you for a tremendously interesting and fast-paced presentation. My apologies for doubting that you would be able to get through all of those slides in the time that we had available. That was very well done. Thanks as well to all who have joined us and are listening to us by phone or online. Until we talk again, please stay away from those prairie dogs and goodbye.